Good evening. April 25th, 2013, James McCanney here with my Science Hour. A lot of information to cover tonight. Tonight's main science topic, I'll be talking about some very special conditions regarding Comet Hale-Bopp. Back in the 1990s, the mid-90s, a comet called Hale-Bopp, which was a medium-sized comet, at the time it seemed like a big comet, stayed in the solar system for a period of 6 years. And there was some data, some wonderful data that was taken by a professional astronomer in Florida, but he took it with his own private equipment and released this and basically took many photos of Comet Hale-Bopp, which gave us an inside view of this comet, the inside structure of a comet, something you do not see with the naked eye or even a good telescope or infrared telescope. He used in particular what is known as a Swan filter. So basically what's happening is water is forming in the comet tail. It's highly ionized, it's hot, steamy water. And they're coming in multiple streamers, very tightly bound streamers, very luminescent streamers. And this is locked inside of what we normally see as the beautiful symmetric comet tail. And by the way, this brings up a whole plethora of points. And so anybody who looks at this data, and of course the professional scientists have to be looking at this data, that the symmetry in the comet coma could not possibly come from a sublimating, melting ice ball. How could it be so 100% all of the time perfectly symmetrical? It doesn't make sense. Where does the hydrogen, the ionized hydrogen cloud, come from that symmetrically, perfectly symmetrically surrounds the comet? That's a space charge sheath that surrounds the comet. All of this predicted by my plasma discharge comet model. All of this explained. But the thing I want to concentrate on tonight is that beautiful inner structure of a comet, something that each week I'm somewhat peeling back the onion, so to speak, giving you layers and layers. I've talked about the spectroscopy of comets. I've talked about the color of comets. These are very complex scientific topics, but I'm trying to give you this a slice, a piece at a time, so that you understand the complex nature of comets. And it's rather silly when you see that someone, professional science astronomers, are talking about the dirty snowball comet model, which only can do one thing. It can only melt in this sublimated. Sublimated means going from the frozen state to the gaseous state, and then moving outwards. Why is gaseous water white? That's another wonderful question. The fact is it isn't white. It's transparent. So water going from an ice state sublimating into a gaseous state would not be white. It wouldn't reflect white light. None of the properties you see in a comet would be there, including that beautiful symmetry, if these sprays, these unwieldy random sprays were coming off of the comet nucleus. How does the sunlight get to that comet nucleus to keep the nucleus spraying material off if the nucleus is blocked, the solar light is blocked from getting to the nucleus by the cloud that surrounds the comet nucleus? And so it's counterproductive. The model doesn't work. And then when they actually went to visit comet nuclei, the last nail in the coffin should have been when they actually looked at comet nuclei and saw that there was no water, no ice, no snow, no H2O in any form sitting on the comet nucleus. Additionally, there was none coming off the comet nucleus. You saw a hot, dry rock They sent a probe into one of the comets, Comet Tempel 1, with the Deep Impact probe, and dust came out of the hole. So they said, gee, well, the water must be deeper. Well, it's a moot point, because water would have to come off of that nucleus to form the tail. From the distance, from a distance, you can see the water in the tail. You can see it spectroscopically, so you know the water's there. And it's in a white form, which means that it's forming droplets. It's in a very hot form, which on Earth we call steam. And so where is the water coming off this nucleus that's forming steam in the tail region? Well, it just, from one end to the other, it doesn't make any sense at all when you imagine a ice ball. So as I peel another layer off of this comet, of the comet observations tonight, and I talk about Hale-Bopp, something that NASA was not very happy about when these pictures hit the internet and they were taken up and demonstrated by many web pages to show that Comet Hale-Bopp, in fact, had this inner structure. And how does that work? Okay, so that's the main science topic tonight. But something very interesting happened. And so before the show here, of course, I do a series of checks on all of the web pages, especially the misinformation web pages that come out of the government sources. I looked on a web page called spaceweather.com, which is a NASA mouthpiece, and the very first thing it said there is Hubble sees Comet Ison. Now, Comet Ison is C2012S1 Ison, and it's just kind of casually referred to as Comet Ison, but it says that this new picture from the Hubble telescope shows Comet Ison. Key information can be derived from this photo. And then you click on the link, and there's nothing there. It doesn't go anyplace. It comes up one of the, page not found. So what's that all about? NASA provided spaceweather.com a Hubble Space Telescope picture of Comet Ison, and the link fails. What's that all about? So at any rate, hate to waste time on my show enumerating these kind of things, but it's showing the silliness of what's going on in standard science today regarding comets. The lines are being drawn very clearly these days. I've been a guest on some top early morning radio shows recently, and the Joyce Riley show. In fact, if you haven't heard these interviews, you have to go listen to these. I believe one is the 11th of March. Absolutely have to listen to that one. It's the 18th. I'm sorry. It's the 18th of March. Joyce Riley, first and second. There's two. It's not the first hour. It's the second and third hour of the Joyce Riley Power Hour show. And then it's a week and a half later on a Friday. So I believe that's a March 29th. But you can check the archives there, and you'll find those shows. Really, really, really good interviews, really good commentary, really good listener questions, something that you have to listen to. This past week, every week, usually Tuesday or Wednesday, I'm a guest with John Moore. On his show, usually a lot of good commentary there also. We talk about what's going on currently, and typically very good listener comments and questions at that with John also. Last week, and this is a little story that I want to count that happened this week, I was on a guest on Bill Deagle's show, Bill Deagle's Medical Hour, and we were talking about Comet Ison, and Dr. Bill went into somewhat of a long discussion about his belief, and we've been discussing this, bannering this back and forth a few times recently when I've been on his show, that there's the possibility that Comet Ison could, as it rounds the sun, interact with the sun, because here we have what is supposed to be the comet of the century coming in nose to nose with the sun. And believe that there could be a solar flare coming off of that baby and interacting, especially, I mean, it's got a perfect alignment electrically with Mercury. This baby's going to be electrically active, let's put it that way, as it approaches the sun. So could there be a possibility of solar flaring, solar activity? Yes. Could one of those flares come out and hit Earth? Well, yeah. But space is a big three-dimensional area. The sun has many, many solar flares, and it's had some very powerful solar flares, but they go in other directions. So there's all kinds of factors here. But anyway, at any rate, we were discussing this, and actually it was Dr. Bill who was doing the majority of talking about that particular event, and then relating it to securing basically martial law, getting the public under control if something like that happens. I've discussed many times that the possibility of a false flag event where the government will take a solar flare and a solar flare event and pull the electric grid, pull the lever and shut down the entire country of the U.S., maybe Canada, Mexico, maybe some other countries also. And I said there's a number of ways to tell if it's a false flag event. First of all, if it's only the United States and not Canada, not Mexico, not our neighbors, and not other places in the world, then you know that this is a false flag event and somebody's pulling the lever. The other key is very subtle, in that a solar flare, we always talk, and I've been on Coast to Coast how many dozen times talking about this possibility, solar flares can affect us, it can take down the power grid, but understand something. Even a major event like the Harrington event is not going to take out the entire grid. Some of it will survive, as with any kind of major natural or man-made event or bombing or whatever you want to take. Something is going to survive, some piece of it. And so if the entire grid goes down 100%, then you know it's somebody pulling that lever and using a false flag event. So these are indicators, and I'm talking about this. And of course, this is one of many, many, many possible events that could occur as Comet Isan comes through the solar system, because there's many alignments. And I talk specifically about January 12th, 2014, and I'll get into that date a little bit later in the show. Just remember that date, one of my predictions. I talked previously about the red hand of death, the possibility of powder coming in from a connection, as Comet Isan will be out between Jupiter and Earth. If we get a connection via the comet out to Jupiter, we could see something that Earth has not seen in thousands of years, reported by the ancients, where that red sulfur dioxide filters into the upper atmosphere, and then we would be getting arcs of electrical arcs also from the comet, causing upward noctiluminescent clouds and auroras, all of that upper atmospheric electrical activity. And so, at any rate, I made those predictions. But anyway, what's funny here, the reason I'm recounting being on Bill Deagle's show this week as a guest and talking about Comet Isan, and in specific, one of the possibilities where it comes in near the sun could cause a solar flare that could affect Earth, is that Tuesday morning, I believe it was, some woman calls in, and I didn't hear this myself, but some woman calls in to Alex Jones, a top-rated daytime talk show host for alternative radio on the planet. And, of course, Alex is a hard-hitting news reporter. But Alex has some topics that he won't talk about on his show. He doesn't introduce them. I've never been a guest on his show, which seems rather strange. It's one of the few shows that I've never been a guest on. But at any rate, certainly Alex knows me. He's mentioned my name when on Coast to Coast when they had a panel talking about secret societies. So it's not like it's a secret, you know. But anyway, be that as it may, no big deal. But at any rate, a woman calls in and she says, Jim McCanny is saying the comet Ison could come near the sun, cause a solar flare that could affect our solar grid, and that's why the government is trying to get martial law in place. And from what I understand, Alex Jones negates this and says, nah, there's nothing to that. Go home, forget about it. So like I say, I didn't hear it myself. That's kind of a paraphrase, but I find it comical because I guess Alex now is a space scientist, astronomer, specialist in Comet Ison and all of the effects and possible things that could happen from Comet Ison. And then relating that to political, possible political ramifications. So the lines are being drawn here and they're getting real funny. But I always wanted to, you know, Alex has his show, lots of people have their shows, and none of us completely agree 100%. You couldn't put us all in a room and have everybody agree. I wouldn't never say that, but I've always wondered, where does Alex get all his money from? It's always amazed me, because us people out here that are, say, selling our books, selling our videos, or whatever, it's pretty clear that you don't become a zillionaire, you don't get big bucks, you don't have a staff of 30 by doing what we're doing. Ask the other people that are in this, this, I don't know if you'd call it business, but it's like what you do to, I do it because it allows me to bring my information to the public with a commercial free venue. But my question is, clearly Alex has got a lot of dough floating around his show, and where does that come from? It's not from selling CDs and videos, but you can answer that question, think about it a little bit. But, you know, there's certain things that Alex won't talk about, and if you have an open venue talk show that has that scope, why don't you talk about Planet X? If you think it's crazy, then put some people on there to talk about it and cover both sides of the issue. But it doesn't happen. So what's that all about? Anyway, there is a real issue to Planet X, and a lot of people don't want to talk about it. A lot of people want to say, oh, well, in 2003, some crazy lady predicted that Planet X was supposed to be here, and it didn't come, so that's the end of the story. Well, no. There's a lot to that, and that was a constructed government misinformation campaign, so don't quote that. Don't throw that in anybody's face as a reason for not talking about Planet X. That's the silliest reason on the planet. So if that's what you're basing your opinion on, then you better go stick your head back in the sand. I want to change gears here and talk about a comet that is visible in the early morning sky right now called Comet Lemon, C2012 F6 Lemon. Lemon is spelt with two M's, and it comes from a search observatory called Lemon. It's the abbreviation, the mnemonic for that observatory. But at any rate, a number of months ago, a lot of major announcements about this comet. It came in very bright, and it was glowing a brilliant green. And so I had a few little exchanges there with spaceweather.com. They had posted that this was due to reflected light from some of the chemistry in the tail, and I slammed that all over the place saying that gases don't reflect lights. And I gave many examples. I gave some examples on my show that if you put these gases in a test tube and you shone sunlight through it, nothing would reflect back to you. It's basically transparent. The only way you're going to get that brilliant green color is if there's an electric current passing through the comet and it's lighting up like a light bulb, the plasma discharge comet model, in other words. So at any rate, about that time, all of the information, literally all of the information on Comet Lemon stopped. A comet like this typically has many photos on spaceweather.com, has photos. A lot of the JPL sites have place where amateurs can post photos, but Comet Lemon was an exception. Nobody, including if you look for Google searches or JPL, none of the standard places where you would find photos typically had any posted. The last photos posted were the ones that were publicly available back in February or early March. Well, we're at the end of April, and also, oddly enough, the viewing charts for this comet are simply not there. These are things that are typically put out by amateur astronomy web pages that show interest in comets for their interested viewing and listening audiences and internet web for internet web interest. But Comet Lemon, there is nothing. And of course, I've been pounding on this, that there was an alignment heading up here with Mercury. So here's another issue that happened with Comet Lemon. I pulled up the initial data, and I used the ephemeris that's posted at the JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Pasadena, California, NASA website, that is duplicated at the Smithsonian, where they keep the comet data and asteroids and all of the data, and this is available for public viewing. And I pulled up the April 29th as the date when it would have a perfect alignment with the planet Mercury, as it was crossing the ecliptic. And I, on my show a few weeks ago, I explained why crossing the ecliptic was electrically important for comets. So at any rate, all of these factors adding up to the fact that on the 29th of April, Comet Lemon would have a very significant electrical excitation event, possibly sunward spikes. We could possibly even see Mercury going comet, little planet Mercury, and possibly a sunward spike in a highly activation scenario for Comet Lemon itself. So I went back later, and I always do my homework, and I repeat my homework, and I cross-check my work. So I go back later using the same, well, what I thought to be the same ephemeris data, and come up with a date of April 19th. Someone had gone in and changed the data. Now, comets can change their orbits, but not by that much. Then I went back 2 days later, and I got some other people to help me. We started scouring the internet for these ephemeris websites where the data is kept, and found that somebody was changing all of the comets, the significant comets that could have interactions with other planets. Somebody was in there changing all the data on a regular basis. Now, understand that these are automated systems, so it takes some real effort, some real constituted effort to make these changes and to put them in there, and it's not anybody that can do this. So this is clearly black ops, and clearly the motivation is so that people, including amateurs, cannot find and locate these objects. And one of the obvious points here is that they're trying to ruin the data so that when I do my analysis, that the data is messed up, and of course you're going to come up with incorrect results. So I went back, and all of a sudden the dates for the ecliptic crossing had changed back to the 26th. Now they were changing also the planetary ephemeris information, so the planets were out of line. And then on a web page, another web page that simply quoted the ecliptic crossing of Comet Lemon, they quoted it as April 22nd. So now we have four different dates that supposedly comes off the same database for the ecliptic crossing of Comet Lemon. That's when it crosses the ecliptic plane, the plane of the planets, or more specifically, the plane that Earth goes around the sun in a plane, its Earth's orbit, and that we define as the ecliptic. So at any rate, this has all been more than strange. So what I've had to do is start to gather my own data to cross-reference the professional ephemeris. The ephemeris is the word for basically all of the data, the numbers, the orbital information that goes along with comets, asteroids, and other objects. But of course, I don't have the kind of equipment that the military has, using space-based telescopes, using Earth-based search telescopes, highly professional automated telescopes that are working 24/7, or the infrared scopes on Haleakala that are based with military, hooked into some of the biggest supercomputer installations in the world. I just don't happen to have that equipment handy, you see. And so it makes it rather tough for me to get around, observe all of these comets, and get correct data and point out the incorrect data that's being placed on these web pages. So I just want to point that out. However, be that as it may, any morning now, Comet Lemon. Now, I told people that I would announce when and where to look for these comets. And starting around this weekend, the 26th, 27th of April, anybody in the northern hemisphere, now, if you're at around 30 degrees north latitude, so that would be like Florida, the southern United States, you would be able to start seeing Comet Lemon already in the early morning sky. And here's what you do. If hopefully you have a beautiful, clear sky, we just have this one night left. Right now we're dealing with a full moon, unfortunately. And so the moon will be setting in the west when this comet will be coming up in the east. So it's really not that big a problem, is the fact that we have a full moon going on right now. Look to the eastern sky right before the sun comes up, and then look up and a little bit to the right of the sun, and just keep your eyes up there, and you should see the tail of the comet sticking out to the right, or up and to the right in that direction. You might see little Mercury out there also. If you know where to look for Mercury, just look a bit beyond Mercury, and you should see this comet. If you have some binoculars, that will help. But also, I always have to stress, do not look directly at the sun with binoculars. So be very cautious of that. So starting basically tonight in the southern United States, working through the weekend coming up, the southern moving into the mid-latitudes United States and then north, or else the equivalent in Europe and around the other points of the globe, the southern latitude or the more southerly latitudes like, say, Mexico, say the Hawaiian Islands, or say Africa, if you're in those regions, Australia, of course, anything in the southern hemisphere has had a good view of this comet already. But that's something that's very strange, because the excellent, excellent amateur astronomers from around the world should be taking vast numbers of pictures of this comet, but none of them, absolutely none of them, visible or being allowed to be placed on the internet. So that's just strange, the amount of strangeness going on and hiding information regarding comets, and keeping the public from seeing these comets and comet information. This past week, an announcement, I'll make this brief as I can. NASA came out with a theory, they call it, and some guy who has never published regarding cometary information before, but some guy who's a specialist on Earth meteorites, and of course they come from comets, but is stating that there's going to be two very strange but specific dust streams that come off Comet Ison, and they will come from, one was going to go around the sun with Comet Ison, and one is going to be beamed directly at Earth, kind of like a shotgun blast, very narrow shotgun blast, and both are going to hit Earth from opposite sides on January 12, 2014. And the effects are going to be fine powder that could float down in the atmosphere and electrical effects in the upper atmosphere. Now, this, I discussed this with some people that know me very well, some other talk show hosts, and the general comment came back is that NASA is shadowing Jim McCaney and his work. Now, you'll all make note that a number of months ago, I made the prediction that on January 12th, 2014, Comet Ison would now be in a position up above us and moving out towards Jupiter. And I said on that date, because of the new moon passing and because of also an electrical connection we have at the same time with the planet Venus, we are going to have a cross-solar system electrical connection. And if Comet Ison connects into Jupiter, we could get some soft, powdery influx of sulfur dioxide and other powdery type of chemicals that are sulfur chemicals that surround Jupiter. And that's why Jupiter is the orange planet. I talked a little about that last week. But I said two effects. One is we could see some upper-level auroras where these could connect in. We could also see some severe weather. But we could see something we have not seen in thousands of years, and that's this fine powder filtering into the upper atmosphere. Well, all of a sudden, on April 19th, this last week, NASA comes out, basically duplicates all of what I'm saying, but attributes it to these amazing computer-modeled special because no other comet in history has ever done this before, or will it ever do it in the future. It's only Comet Ison, and it has two very special meteor streams, a very fine powder, not anything big now, just only fine powder, coming one from one direction and one that's going to follow this comet all the way through the solar atmosphere, come out around the other side, and then be redirected at Earth. Now, mind you, meteor streams follow very closely the orbits of comets. And so when we run into, like, the Leonids, which are going on right now, they are the result of the comet streams that resulted from comets that passed through this region of the solar system a long time ago. Excuse me, I meant to say the Lyrids. It's another meteor stream that Earth is experiencing right now. But the point is that these meteor streams are very localized, and they stay in this path, and the Earth might pass through them in a single night, for a very short period of time. But what's comical about this new amazing theorization coming out of NASA, first of all, is computer modeled. And anytime somebody says computer modeling, I'm always kind of amazed, because people get this impression is that, wow, it's computer modeled, it must be correct, because computers are always correct. But computers depend on what input you put into them. What are your assumptions? What are the assumptions that you put into this? And so clearly, somebody is molding this to get a specific result. And why only little fine dust grains? Why aren't the bigger ones? Why aren't little chunks of rock flying in at the same time? See, it's shadowing exactly what my prediction is. About a month ago, some clown from Israel published a paper in an astrophysics journal saying that comets, little snowballs now, could hit the sun and cause big CMEs to come out of the sun, something that NASA has denied emphatically over the decades and decades. Every time a comet would come in and interact with the sun, and big flare would come off, they'd go, oh, coincidence, and spaceweather.com and all of these NASA mouthpiece websites, the Naval Observatory, etc., would bend over backwards trying to just tell you what a coincidence this was, and there's no scientific basis or evidence for this. Now, all of a sudden, they got some guy who's never published regarding comets before, and see, they always go out and get these no-name, over-on-the-side guys to do their dirty work. Not the Don Yeomans, or not the Carrie Lisses, or not the Michael Mumas, or not the whole laundry list, not the Hal Weavers. No, they don't put their name on it. Not the Ali Hainaus. No, they don't put their names on it. They get some no-name clown to do this for him, to put his name on it, And you see what I'm saying. They put up this phony information. Now, how does a snowball that's 10 feet across come into the sun and interact with the core of the sun where there's nuclear fusion, and that's according to their story, and then send out an interactive pulse? The core of the sun takes, if there were such a situation, and it's not even true, the fusion of the sun is up at the surface. But how does a little snowball come in and hit the sun and affect a solar flare? It's just absurdity, fairy tale science. But you see what's going on. NASA is trying to get all its ducks in a row, and everything they're doing is trying to negate my work so that they've got an excuse. They got their pat answer to go to. They got the go-to guy ready when the event happens. And so that's why I get a kick out of Alex Jones. He goes, oh, no, McCanny couldn't be right on that. They even got Alex Jones trying to slam me. The level of success that I'm having in teaching the public exactly what's going on with comets, the electrical conditions of comets, the plasma discharge comet model, my success is getting so big that NASA is literally every week shattering literally everything I do, and doing everything they can to try and trounce my name and work. Okay, so on to the science, main science topic for the night. I'm going to be talking about Hale-Bopp. Back in the 90s, when this hit the street, now Hale-Bopp was another comet that caused an immense amount of controversy. I'm not going to go into that tonight. I've talked about that many times on my show. But the point is that a professional astronomer from Florida began taking time-lapse photography of comet Hale-Bopp with a Swan filter. Now, what that does is it sees through all of the unionized and lightly ionized gases and dust and only looks at the hydrogen and oxygen components of the gases in the comet tail. And they are highly ionized, and what it looks like are big snakes that are coming into the comet nucleus. These are streamers. They're extremely hot. They're doubly, triply ionized, which tells you that they're very hot. They're extremely hot. And so these are chemicals that are forming in the comet tail. They're coming in streamers. Why are they coming in bundled streamers? Well, it's called the pinch effect, something that I discussed early in my work. One of my papers, a 1986 paper, called Dynamics of a Small Comet, where I was discussing the plasma event and results of the IC3 spacecraft that went through the tail of Comet Giacobini-Zinner. This was in 1986, prior to the Halley's Comet flyby of the French Giotto spacecraft, etc. And so, anyway, as the ISEE3 satellite approached the tail of Comet Giacobini-Zinner, it started to see a magnetic field that would rise up, then positive, then drop down negative, then flip up to positive, and then down to negative. And so what we're seeing were these bundled streamers of electrically charged current flowing into the comet nucleus. And coming out the other way was the electron streams that was following the same path, neutralizing these as they settled in towards into the comet nucleus. When in a small comet like that, it doesn't have enough gravitational field to hold those chemicals. So as they become neutralized, the solar wind picks them up and blows them out, and that's what the NASA scientists see as neutrals, neutral ions coming away from the sun, and that's what they're seeing as neutrals, thinking that that's coming from an ice ball. So they're being fooled because they don't understand the whole procedure here. And they had no way, of course, of explaining this flip-up, flip-down magnetic field reading that was coming from the magnetometers on the ISEE3 spacecraft. The ISEE3 spacecraft was a spacecraft that originally was studying the the space plasma region, the Bioshock region of Earth, by a bunch of group of physicists at Goddard Space Flight Center and also a team from Los Alamos Laboratories. But then they had a plan and diverted that spacecraft to be the first spacecraft ever to visit a comet. And so they went to Comet Giacobini-Zinner, crossed through the tail region of the comet, and so let me get back to Comet Hale-Bopp. The bundling of these ions as they flow in. Now let me explain the pinch effect. What's causing the bundling? If you have charge moving in relative to a given frame of reference, so that means there's an electric current. The current is moving with respect to your frame of reference, and so what happens is these moving charged particles bundle up the self-induced magnetic field, and this is a known property of electric current. If you have a wire on Earth or an electric circuit and you have your current electrons moving through a wire, they are contained within that wire, but in outer space there is no wire. It's free moving plasma. So when you have a current that is sufficiently large, you have enough electrical current in the path, then these charged particles start to pull themselves together in a tighter and tighter bundle. The more current there is, the tighter the bundle. And so it becomes a fairly complex interaction between the electrons moving out from the sun and the ions moving in towards the comet nucleus. But at any rate, they bundle up. That's the important point to remember. They bundle up, and that's why these the pictures taken with a Swan filter with an amateur telescope show, in one case, about 17 of these snake-like bundles moving in towards the comet nucleus. And my original theoretical work showed the shape of the field lines. These bundles follow those field lines into the comet nucleus perfectly. But the thing is also is they're out there swinging around like a bunch of snakes, tentacle snakes. So as you see the time-lapse photography of Comet Hale-Bopp, it has these tentacles out there swinging around with the water pouring in to the nucleus along these field lines. And so one of the unsolved problems of Earth, for example, is where did our oceans come from? Where did the chemistry come from that formed our oceans? And you see that in the developing comet, those chemicals are there. It's part of the cometary process. Additionally, Earth, on many occasions, has passed through the tail of large comets. We passed through the tail of Halley's Comet in 1910, and relatively little happened because Halley's Comet is a very small, insignificant comet. But if we were to pass through the tail of, say, Hale-Bopp, I made a calculation one time that we would have, if we would have passed directly through the tail of Hale-Bopp, we would have spent close to 2 months, about 45 days, a month and a half, passing through the comet tail. Well, what would have happened? We would have greatly diminished solar light, so we would have lost a lot of heat input from the sun at that time, plus we would have had a tremendous influx of water and oil. Gee, does that sound familiar? 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain? I wonder if that could have come from a comet. Interesting, yes. In fact, if you look at my two CD set, The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters, I discuss many, many ancient disasters and talk and relate this to space science. But back to Comet Hale-Bopp, the bundling of these electrical currents in the form of ions. Now, that's just water. There are other chemicals coming in also. Now, the Swan filter filters out all of the light coming from any other chemicals and concentrates mainly on the oxygen, the triply ionized oxygen, which is in the process of forming water with hydrogen in the comet tail. So you have the formation of water. This is why when you have small comet nuclei, and NASA has sent out their spacecraft to see the nuclei and taken pictures of them, you don't see any water on the nucleus, yet you see the water in the tail. That is why, because the water comes in, with a large comet it becomes neutralized also, but the large comets have enough gravitational mass to sustain and hold the chemicals as they come in. The little comet nuclei do not have enough gravitational pull, and so the solar wind comes and it basically takes those chemicals back out as neutrals. It's kind of a cyclic process. The other thing that does happen is some of the heavier ions, like the long-chain hydrocarbons, can make it all the way into the comet nucleus, and the electron beam coming out from the sun bakes them onto the comet nucleus, such as in the case of Comet Build 2, where the nucleus was seen as a hot, dry rock, but with tar, basically hydrocarbons, baked onto the surface, and, of course, no water. So, of course, that's a perplexing problem for space scientists who believe in the dirty snowball comet model, because there's no water, there's no snow, there's no ice at all on the surface of the nucleus, but they still call it a dirty snowball. When they crash Comet Tempel 1, when they crashed the Deep Impact space probe into the nucleus, dust came out. Not a trace of water was found. So what did they do? They said, oh, based on Earth-based observations, they thought they saw some excitation, some extra water in the tail of the comet. Therefore, there must have been water coming out of the hole. But the direct observation from the accompanying spacecraft of the Deep Impact spacecraft, the viewing spacecraft with the cameras, viewed absolutely no water coming out of the hole that was created, the crater that was created by the impact probe. So, of course, phonying up data, giving baseless excuses for why they are claiming that the dirty snowball comet model works. But you have to understand, this is tier two science. There's a reason why these scientists are locked in this mode. And the reason is very political. The reason why the public is not allowed to see this, the reason why NASA continues to push what I call flat earth science, is because I've said this many times, there's a very simple tautological, logical set of questions that's going to go through everybody's mind, from grandma to the little child at 4 years old to everybody in between, and when they realize that comets are electrical, that they're causing electrical effects on Earth. That's why they don't want you to look at Comet Eisen as it passes Mars in September, late September of 2013, this coming September. Another great hidden piece of data from NASA. They don't want anybody looking at this because it could cause electrical discharges between the comet and Mars. In fact, it's just about as easy a prediction. It's a very sure bet that Comet Eisen is going to have electrical interactions with the planet Mars this coming September. So, like Comet Eisen, I think that the weather control that has manipulated the entire country now for the last 2 weeks, the United States has been entirely covered with clouds. And I passed this is my observation, but I passed this by people who monitor the weather, people who live in various parts of the country. But the haze cloud cover across the entire United States for a 2 week period or 3 week period when Comet Lemon is passing by is completely, completely unprecedented. But it shows the level of control. They are deathly afraid that the public is going to see these comets. And what's up there now? Well, Comet Lemon, a bright green comet. And that's why these pictures are being blocked from the internet. So anybody that doubts what I'm saying, go to the internet and look for the pictures of Comet Lemon, a brilliant green comet that's up in the sky right now. It's been visible for over a month and a half in the southern hemisphere. Many, many, many great amateur astronomers in Australia, who are always putting out wonderful beautiful photos of comets, none of these are appearing on the internet now. Why is that? Why the lack of pictures of this particular comet? All the other comets, Pan-STARRS, lots of pictures of it. The only picture on spaceweather.com of Comet Lemon is a snapshot, a very out-of-focus snapshot of a camera, like your little handheld digital camera, tourist camera. That's the only picture that's there, and it's about a month old, of Comet Lemon. What's wrong with this picture? You know, anyway, if you want to see what I'm talking about, understand that they are blocking the photos of this comet. A brilliant, big, bright green comet that's observable in the morning sky. And if you happen to have clear weather, as I said, coming up the next this weekend, if you're in the southern United States, it's already there. Get up early in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, and start looking along the eastern horizon, and you should see the tail sticking up. And then as the sunrise proceeds, you'll start to see the planet Mercury. They will be very closely aligned, and then eventually the sun comes up, and as I said, do not look directly at the sun with your eyes. I just want to quickly relate the tails that I spoke of earlier on Comet Hale-Bopp. Now, understand that all comets have these filament bundled streamers of current coming into the comet nucleus. As the nucleus is negatively charged, the ions come in. As they are drawn in and they meet, they're pulled together. They start combining chemically, so you have the whole laundry list of hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon, oxygen, all of the organic compounds forming, all the way up to the nucleotides have been discovered in the tails of comets. So at any rate, the point is I want to make that that the Earth is doing the very same thing. In my weather book, I have a picture of the Earth with a comet tail attached to the upper ionosphere. And these have actually been discovered, the regions of water coming in, and then these electrical currents drive all the way down to the troposphere where we have Earth weather. And so I pointed out one time, for example, there was a big storm system that developed over the upper Midwest in the middle of the night. And there was no water coming in from the Pacific or the Gulf or any of the oceans. There was no water content in the atmosphere. In fact, it was very dry. But as this storm system developed, all of a sudden there was an incredible amount of water, and it dumped about 12 inches of rain up in the along the Canadian border and along the a little town or a little city called Duluth, Minnesota. The water was rushing down the street so fast that it actually took the roads out. It dug underneath the roads and did a tremendous amount of damage, 11 to 12 inches of rain in a couple of hours. Where did that water come from? The water came from outer space. Because as you look at the replay, so to speak, of the weather system developing, the Weather Service couldn't predict it. They didn't predict it. They had no concept that it was even coming. And so once the rain started, the people were trapped there. But where did all that water come from? It wasn't in the storm system, because the storm system didn't even exist a number of hours earlier. So that water literally came in from outer space. And so I was once at a meeting, I was talking about this at a conference, and a very astute young man stood up and he said, well, with all of this water that you're saying is coming into the atmosphere, wouldn't the lake levels and the ocean levels be rising, etc.? And I said, well, first of all, you have to understand that the amount of water coming in even a big storm like this would be minuscule compared to the amount of water in the oceans. But the point is, there is a hydrological cycle that the water evaporates, It goes up into the atmosphere. It comes down as rain. It goes up into the atmosphere. And as this cycles, that each cycle moves in a northern kind of a spiral helical motion up towards the northern, in a northerly direction in the northern hemisphere and in a southerly direction in the southern hemisphere. So much of the water that cycles up through our system, our weather systems, actually eventually ends up at the North Pole and the South Pole. And that's why these, the North Pole and the South Pole, are layering up. There was once a series of airplanes, World War II airplanes, that made an emergency landing up near the North Pole. And so the pilots decided something like 40 or 50 years later to go back, and they thought, let's go back and find the planes. And so they went back there. There was nothing there. They dug down, and I can't remember. It was tremendously deep where they finally encountered the planes. And so all of this ice had built up on top in just a short period of 50 years. So that's where the water goes. It cycles up to the North and the South Pole. And so that's why we don't see the ocean levels and the lake levels increasing a great deal, even though this water is constantly coming into Earth. It ends up at the poles, layering up at the poles. So at any rate, I just want to mention that, remember my webpage, www.jmccsci.com, my new release, the ebook, the weather, or the book Comets is there. All of the other books and videos, CDs, DVDs, etc., are on the web page. All of my radio shows going back a dozen years are located on the web page. Go to the archive, the weekly radio show archive subpage, and listen. There, all of these shows are as meaningful now as when I recorded them years ago. These are all my live shows from many years of radio. There's also a lot of other information there, some recorded radio shows on book releases, etc., but over close to 5 gigabytes of information on that webpage. So a lot of information there. Remember the webpage, jmccsci.com, 7 letters, www.jmccsci.com. S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. The new release, Comets, is a book that gives you a historical perspective and a modern perspective on comets. And this 2013 is the year of the comets. We're going to see some major league comets coming through the solar system this year, so get ready. Once again, I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.